For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
So this evening I'm happy to have Eric Schutt giving the talk this evening. Eric is a member of our practice council and also leads our affiliated group down in Hyde Park every Wednesday afternoon at 5:30 in Rockefeller Chapel in the big cathedral in the center of Hyde Park. So anyone who's down there is welcome to that. So, Eric, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tekken. Good luck with this, folks. I want to talk tonight about blood and breath. I'd like to talk about it in a couple of ways. And partly, I want to frame it in, a few of you were down at the Smart Museum last Wednesday, where we were able to sit in the presence of some early Buddhist images from China, and Tygon spoke, and two of the things that came up in that talk were sort of an invitation to think a little bit more expansively than we sometimes do about the time scales that are involved in our practice and in our lives, and also invited us to consider the way in which images can be teachings, that they show something, that the face of a bodhisattva engraved on stone conveys something. That something is a little bit different than saying something. It shows something. And so I'd like tonight to really, rather than try to say something so much, although I'll be speaking, of course, to put before you some images and invite you to consider your practice in the light of those images. And I want to start with the Bodhisattva vow, and I want to end with the Bodhisattva vow. But I'm going to take a kind of a roundabout way to get from the beginning to the end. So I can speak to about 8:30, something like that?
Yeah, they're a little bit longer.
Okay. It may not take that long. But first off, I think most of us here in the last half hour or so have probably been attending to our breath. Some of us may be doing other things or doing other things along with that, but I just would like you to take a moment and do that again. Just pay attention to your breath for a moment. See it come and go. And now, I'd like you to, you know, maybe put your fingers on your wrists or on your heart and locate your pulse, locate your heartbeat. Those things are really interesting. As long as we're around as interested parties, I mean, these things are both going to come to an end, but as long as we're here, as small beings, they will be with us. When they leave, who knows? But think about it the other way. You know, some of us are, you know, 50 years old, 60 years old, 40 years old, whatever we are, and that heartbeat has gone on without fail, you know, from the very beginning of, you know, from before we came into consciousness, that was there. That breath was there, sort of coming with absolute dependability again and again and again. I invite you to look further backwards. where did that start? You know? We had it when we emerged into this world from our mother's wombs. You know, it was transmitted to us. It was already there for us. Somehow, you know, it became ours. It became different. But at some point, it was the same. And not only with us and our mothers, but with our mother's mother. And our mother's mother's mother. And in fact, you know, goes all the way back, you know, without stop. So whose is it? Really, whose is it? What is it? It's hard to say, you know, but we have it now. You know, it supports us, and we attend to it. So it goes back a long ways, and it involves a lot of beings. So I say, you know, it came to me through my mother, came to me through my father. They each had parents, and, you know, so I have two parents, I have four grandparents, I have 32 great-grandparents. It goes on and on and on. By the time we get to 10 generations, I calculate today, there are 4,096 people involved. You know, this is very, very shallow in historical time. I mean, this is the barest sliver. What does this take us back? You know, 250 years maybe? But... you know, and not only that, but all of those people, it's not like one line. It's like for each of those people, they all have, you know, going back 10,000 generations, 4,096 people. The numbers very, very quickly become huge. In fact, you know, the numbers would quickly become, you know, if they were all discrete and separate, more beings, more human beings that have ever lived on Earth, which means, of course, that we share a lot of ancestors. We go back a little ways. You know, we probably would, if we had the means to do it, we could probably, you know, go back not too far and do the same thing they do in every presidential election. You know, it turns out that Jimmy Carter's second cousin was Ronald Reagan's first cousin's uncle. That kind of thing. There's a lot of overlapping. You know, we really are, in some concrete way, one family. But it doesn't stop there. Because human beings don't go back very far. I have to refer to my notes. So, you know, I've been here for 56 years. Modern humans have been around for 30,000 years. Homo sapiens have been around for 300,000 years. Homo erectus for 900,000. Hominids for 2.5 million. Mammals for 60 million. Animals and fungus, about 900 million years. And we're still just sort of getting back to the beginning, because it goes back to the origins of life like 3.7 billion years. You know, it's a long time. And the thing is, there's no point, you know, so we, you know, I say that little line of, you know, okay, humans, hominids, whatever, mammals, but there's no point at which, you know, any of that's discrete. If you go back, you know, I mean, at some point, leaving aside, at some point we go beyond even sexual reproduction, but that goes a long ways back. And to that point, it's not, you know, first this, then that, then that, then that. It's just a sequence of, you know, mothers and children, you know, mothers watching their own only over their only child, you know. So what am I trying to say? So there's a real, you know, in a very real sense, in just this sort of biological way, you know, there's this little fizz of separation, you know, that we experience now. But basically, you know, it's, we're very closely related. And this, I should have started with this, but this is... I want to connect this to the Bodhisattva vow. We say here, all beings, one, all beings are numberless. I vow to save them. And that's really, you know, we have these four vows, but that's the heart. That's, as far as I can see, that's the one that identifies, that's what makes the Bodhisattva vow the Bodhisattva vow. The other ones are, that, I mean, that's the heart of the Mahayana. The other ones can be taken by solitary Buddhas, you know, to master the way of Buddha, to meet delusion, all those things. But that one, that's really the heart. And there's another way of putting it that other sanghas use sometimes, which is all beings, one body, I vow to liberate. And so this picture that I just drew was to sort of indicate the way we do sort of share one body. It's just, it's breath, it's blood, it's this thing we don't understand. We don't know where it came from, but it goes all the way back and it continues. Not for us, you know, we're a bubble, but there's this thing. But nonetheless, the bubble is ours at this moment. That's really important. So that's one way of tracing, you know, who we are, where we came from. But, you know, when you go back through these numberless beings, we very quickly can become confused. So we trace that in certain kinds of ways. In our culture, we do that through our names, which are given through our fathers, and that's usually, and that's one way of doing it. It's a very common way of doing it. There are other ways of doing it, but you know, so like I'm Eric Schutt, and my dad was Merrill Moran Schutt, and his dad was Merrill Morgan Schutt, and it kind of goes back and back and back, And it's an important function. It keeps things straight. It lets us find our way back a certain ways into this mass of whatever. And not only that, but these people, these families, are charged. You know, we're part of this one big family, but there's these little clusters, and these people are charged with educating us and nurturing us and, you know, preparing us to sort of go forward on our own. But, you know, it's hard to see both of those pictures at once. And as Dogen says, when one side is illuminated, the other side is dark. So when we illuminate that side of personal identity, these other things tend to disappear. These other relationships, they're no less real, but they fall into the dark. We don't see them in quite the same way. Immediately speaking, I mean, looking back through that kind of patriarchal thing, just as an aside, you know, one whole huge class disappears right away. That's the mothers. It's much more dramatic than that, because of those, you know, going back, you know, 10 generations, 4,096 ancestors, the ones who would be named in that kind of sequence, except for sort of collateral things, would be 10 men. So in other words, roughly 2,000 people disappear, 2,000 men disappear, and together with all the women. All this is to say that, you know, that line is in some ways arbitrary, but it conceals a lot, and even though it conceals a lot, it's not false. It's a particular way of performing, like a very necessary function of allowing us to situate ourselves and keep ourselves organized and straight. So, who is it who's, you know, sitting on this mat and cushion? You know, Taigen often says, when we sit on this mat and cushion, we sit together with all beings. And I'm trying to suggest that there's a very sort of, I mean, I'm trying to draw a picture and suggest, not argue, but suggest that there's a way in which that's very literally true. you know, each of us fully embodies, you know, this history of 3.7 billion years. You know, a lot has sort of come and gone, but we fully are present as, you know, outcomes of that entire span, that entire sequence of numberless beings rising and falling. So, Tigan has also said, other people have said, that there's a way in which we choose our parents. That's pretty cryptic. So, you know, how should we understand that? One way that I understand it is when we talk about choosing, we're talking about volitional action. When we're talking about volitional action, we're talking about karma. So to say that we choose our parents is one way. Another way of saying that, perhaps, is that, you know, particular people are situated in this massive network. You know, they come to be this particular time, this particular place, surrounded by these particular people as a function of karma. Those relationships are in some sense karmic. So, I've been talking about our big, big biological family. Now I'd like to talk about sort of the Buddha family, the family we join, that we become part of when we receive the practice of Zazen, and when we take the precepts, receive the precepts, we can see, you know, looking back, you know, we have those sort of same kind of family trees in Buddhism, you know, through a series of karmic relations. We find ourselves in a particular time, we find ourselves in a particular place, we find ourselves with a particular teacher who gives us what we need to sustain ourselves as members of that family. Specifically, we learn Zazen and we embrace the precepts. It's sometimes said that the precepts are the blood that flows through the veins of the Buddhas. So when we find ourselves in here, in this situation, as others find themselves in other parts of the world, in other rooms, in other situations, they are taking on the body of the Buddha. This blood that's been flowing back beyond Shakyamuni continues to pump, continues to be regularly delivered. You know, in our Zazen practice, the breath continues to come. And so again, this is just a picture. This isn't an argument. I'm trying to sort of draw an analogy between our family as sentient beings and our families as members of the Buddha's family, as bodhisattvas, as people who practice. And again, there's a certain amount of very important and legitimate bookkeeping that takes place as part of that. And I don't mean to be facetious or limiting or anything like that, but that's part of what, you know, lineage is. You know, so we have, you know, people who take a particular teacher, have that teacher, and they they look to that teacher's teacher, and it goes back, and you start to see these relationships, and it situates you in a certain place in this much bigger family. And it sort of expands in the same way as when we went backwards in our biological sense of, you know, it goes back and back and back, and the circle gets bigger and bigger and bigger. But nonetheless, you know, certain particular people encounter each other karmically, and one of those people is charged as a teacher with transmitting precepts and transmitting the practice of Zazen. So we have pictures of that. I'm going to show you one. It's just like what we see in family trees. This is from a book about Dogen. So you've all seen these things, lineage charts. You know, it's sort of one guy to one guy to one guy. You know, unfortunately, we have the same problems with this as we have in tracing our family names. But you see the picture. It's a picture, but this is not the only picture. There's another picture. Okay, so I've talked about this, the blood that runs through the veins of the Buddhas, the precepts. When we receive the precepts, many of you know this, you've received them, and you're aware of it, but that ceremony, part of that ceremony, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's termed Kechi Myaku. It's the blood vein. It represents this sort of continuity. And so I showed you that lineage chart that in this particular case is for Dogen. But I'll show you another way in which that's represented. And this is a way in which, if those of you who've taken the precepts or have seen, because it's in your lineage papers, it's the same thing. It's from person to person to person to person to person. But there's one very sort of key difference about this way of representing it. Because in this case, we have Shakyamuni Buddha in the middle, and it goes from teacher to student to teacher to student to teacher to student, and in this case to Dogen. But when you receive the precepts, it's you who would be in that position. And then it goes back directly to Buddha. So what does this show? I think it shows something like what I was trying to say about the way in the biological family, you know, there are many, 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 many ancestors. And that entire history, if it exists anywhere, if it has any meaning now, it's because it resides in us. So in this picture of these sort of one-to-one relations, you know, teacher to student, teacher to student, teacher to student, it seems very sort of dyadic. And, you know, so the question becomes, okay, you know, one side is illuminated, one side is dark. What's in the dark in that picture? It's all the other beings that have been involved and have supported us, our teachers, our practice, going back, you know, to when Shakyamuni taught. The number's huge. But if that's to have anything to do with us, there's a way in which it only makes sense if those people are in fact sitting with us now on our mats and cushions. So what I'd like to suggest is in that last link of this long chain when it goes from us to Buddha, this bloodline goes back from us to Buddha, that all beings, sorry, that's upside down, this way, all beings are, in a sense, present in the same way that all beings reside with us in our biological selves. But what does that mean? Part of what that means is that, you know, what do you make of a picture like this? It's like a heart, you know? It's like a circulatory system. It's like if it's broken, you know, what happens if the bloodline's broken, you know? Buddha dies. So in a way, I mean, where's the nourishment? The nourishment can only come by way of us. You know, if the meaning of biological evolution is to be anything, it's here. Likewise, if the Buddha's teaching is to be alive, is to be meaningful, to have anything to do with anything, it has to do with us. You know, the bloodline has to flow through us, or the whole thing withers and dies. And that's a... I've completely lost track of my notes. That's all right. And that's okay. That's, in a way, it's like an awesome kind of responsibility, right? But on the other hand, it's not such a problem, because let's talk about the responsibility. Like, so what do we do? What do we do? You know, clearly we can't practice as Ananda did. We can't practice as Dongshan did. You know, we're not Tang Dynasty Chinese. We can't practice as a medieval Chinese guy like Dogen. I mean, Buddha says, be a lamp unto yourself. We have to find our own way to do it. And it's a tricky business. You know, Dogen says, the way is not in Genja Kon, the way has not carried over from the past. It's not just this dead thing that sort of rolls along. But he also says it is not merely arising now. You know, so we have, we have it. You know, now we have it. preserve it well. You know, it's like we have the blood in the precepts, we have the breath in Zazen, you know, we have the Dharma body if we choose to embrace it and embody it and live it. And, you know, it's not necessarily self-evident how that's going to be, but people do it different ways. So, you know, Taigen embodies it, one style of practice, you know, Tai is on Maizumi Roshi, you know, different approach, different style. Mahagosananda, different approach, different style. It's the same big Buddha family. And, you know, we do, you know, we have our little customs, we have our family way of doing things. But, you know, as long as the three treasures are transmitted, we can rely on ourselves. And, so going back to the Bodhisattva vow, it's like, you know, so how do we live up to that responsibility? It's like part of the idea is to give up this notion that, you know, that's my blood, that's my breath, that's my heartbeat. You know, the Bodhisattva vow suggests that we let our hearts sort of beat for all beings, and we let our breaths be for all beings. So I'd just like to finish with a kind of a quote from Bodhidharma. He's from this book called the Bodhidharma Anthology that has translations of documents that were found in, is it the Dunhuan, the caves in Western China that were lost for a long time. But in one of these, it's called Record One, Bodhidharma is asked, what is the Bodhisattva practice? And the answer is this: it is not the practice of worthies and sages. It is not the practice of the common man. It is a practice of the Bodhisattva. If one is training to be a Bodhisattva, one neither seizes worldly dharmas nor rejects worldly dharmas. If you can enter the path with thought and consciousness as they are, there will be no common men or hearers capable of taking your measure. As is said, every locus of events, every locus of forms, every locus of evil karma is used by the Bodhisattva, and all are made into Buddha events. They are all made into nirvana. They are all the great path. The Bodhisattva examines the fact that every locus is the locus of dharma. The Bodhisattva does not reject any locus, does not seize any locus, does not select any locus, and makes them all into Buddha events. Birth and death is made into a Buddha event, and delusion is made into a Buddha event. So, in a way, I think that states what we recite in the Bodhisattva vow to practice for the benefit of all beings, to encounter, take upon ourselves the responsibility of encountering every dharma, everything that we arises in our life, every delusion that we live through, as an invitation to wake up, and so on. So, I don't think, you know, I've talked about waking up. I don't think I've said anything in this talk about enlightenment. But what I'd like to say,
okay, don't have to say.
Well, I don't know anything about it. So, but the thing is, what I want to say is, we don't have to know anything about it. That's, I think, absolutely fine. Because when blood and breath are present, our lives are taking care of themselves. You know, we have decisions to make, things to work out, hassles to go through. But when those are present, we're doing okay. Likewise, when the precepts, Shila, and meditation, zazen, samadhi, are conveyed to us, we don't have to worry, I think. This is personal opinion. I don't know if this is a sanctioned way of putting things, but I think if Shila and samadhi are present, we don't have to worry about prajna. It won't be so far away. Likewise, if dharma is present, and if sangha is present, I think the Buddha can take care of himself. I would say that Buddha is there also. And just to close, you know, going back to this idea of the kechimyaku, this circulation, it's like part of the point of this is like, you know, as I said before, now we have it, you know, we have to take care of it. You know, if the Buddha is going to live, if the Dharma is going to live, if Sangha is going to persist, it's up to what we do. You know, the Buddha doesn't have to take care of us. You know, it's now up to us to take care of the three treasures ourselves. And realize in doing so, we're also supported by them. So, like I said, that's not an argument. Those are a series of pictures, but I hope they show you something. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Eric. Yes. Yes. So I was thinking about all kinds of footnotes to add, but I won't.
Please.
No. Comments, questions, responses for Eric. Okay.
So, Erica, thank you for being a wonderful giant corpuscle floating around nourishing Buddhist body. I had a reaction in thinking about this about, you know, a family style. And it came to the other day. I don't know if anybody knows who Lori David is, but she's the director of Inconvenient Truth. You know, she's some kind of director, radical person. But what she was talking about on the radio was the fact that family meals, if you as a child or your children have family meals together, that you are going to be much healthier in body, speech, and mind. That is, you're going to get a lot less trouble. You won't be as obese in American culture. And there's a whole bunch of data on this. And as a psychologist, I've been paying attention to this for a long time. But there's something about what we do here together about this family meal. And I was thinking really illustrate that so nicely, that we're passing along. One of the things they found was that, you know, what happens at family meals? Most people, like, hate them, right? You know, dinner at 6 every night, you wanted to go out and play with your friends. But what they found happens is that you transmit the family tradition and the family culture at the dinner table, or at tea and cookies, or something like that, or in our Dharma talks. But there's something about us practicing together that somehow is sustaining and nourishing. So I thought you did really wonderful at home. You kind of put that together, so I'm just thank you.
Thank you, Hogetsu. And I think that's a really important point. You know, we all had the experience of going to eat with our friends when we were kids and experiencing a slightly different family culture, and that could be kind of jarring. But I think, you know, so there can be those kinds of differences, but the important thing, I think what you're saying, is that there is a family style, there is a family culture, that we become part of that in some way. This is kind of a whole other sort of sidetrack of what I wanted to talk about, and I just had to drop it, but it's like you thanked me for being a giant corpuscle. That's pretty good. But actually, you know, this big intimate family, you know, of embodied beings, actually in the context of space, it's actually tiny, 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 tiny. You know, we have all those, like, sort of, you've all heard the little factoids about, you know, if the nucleus of an atom is a piece of dust here, the electrons are like a football field away, and da 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 da. But it's actually like, I recently heard that the calculations for the total amount of matter in space is the equivalent of like an apple, you know, every 250,000 miles. It's really, really small. So we're lucky to be so close together. How about a footnote?
Can I see that big book that you have?
Yeah.
What's that book here?
You got it from the library.
Yeah, it's a collection of Dogen's writings, but I looked for it so I could find
and maybe
this picture.
This may be in Shiso, which is one of his essays in Shobo Genzo. Probably in Japan, you would be thrown out of the temple if you held this picture up. Because this is one of the... So going back to what you were saying, first of all, the Kechimyaku is the blood vein that people receive when they formally do the precept-receiving ceremony. And at that one, too, it's a long... This is one kind of version of it, not so much like ours, but there's a Shakyamuni, and it comes down through all the Indian ancestors and Bodhidharma and sixth ancestor and Dogen and so forth, Tsukiroshi and me and you. And then at the bottom of that, there's a line that goes around back up to Buddha too. This document is lovely because it's the same thing as a circle. This is a secret document, though.
Oops.
This is but Dogen writes about it. This is this. There's three Dharma transmission documents. This is one of them, along with the Kechen Nyaku. And there's a third one, and which has a different layout. But they're all ways of talking about what you've been talking about tonight, which is how it's impossible to say. So I like it that you were talking about just giving a snapshot of this, but how deeply interconnected we all are. And there are many families. So there's the family, you know, that you talked about, the genetic family, there's the Buddha family, and we're all connected. And, you know, the different lineages, you know, Gosananda and Dogen and Suzuki Roshi are, you know, split very far apart at, you know, in terms of those lineages, but they're also very close. And so what else do I want to say? Just that and I've talked about the cultural lineages too. We all have many ancestors in the past and in the future, and we have this Buddha family, and we have our genetic families, and Hogetsu has a Western psychology family, you know, a kind of lineage and various inspirational ancestors, and Adam has a lineage and ancestry of soccer players, and you know, anyway, there are all kinds of different ways of different families that coexist in this situation now. So I appreciated the way you kind of brought that forth. It's just very rich that we're here, and each of us, we're all part of Buddha family. Just by virtue of your being here, you are in the Buddha family, whether you identify yourself as a Buddhist or not. Just the fact that you're here tonight, you're part of the Buddha family. And you're also part of many other families. And we all share those families together when we sit in this circle. Yes, Hogetsu-san.
I wanted to add a footnote.
To my footnote.
To your footnote. Eric's footnotes. Because we're a shared family tradition here, I'm aware that not everybody, you know, when you're hearing this thing like Kechen Nyaku and, you know, Buddha family and, you know, so these robes that we wear, whether they're a bit like garments called raksus or larger versions called the okesos, which are priest robes, what happens is at some point someone says to a teacher, could I please receive from you the Bodhisattva precepts? And part of what one receives is a robe, and we sew them in our tradition, but also what you receive is this document, a secret document. You know, most people aren't like whipping out their lineage papers, which is the common way of catching Yaku is. No. So, and you know, some people collect them, right? Get some ordination. I got the Kechen Nyaku from so-and-so, but it's gauche in our school, but it can happen. I've heard this happen. But just so you know kind of what this whole kind of tradition is, so apparently maybe I'd assume Dogen said to somebody, could I please receive the precepts from him?
Sure.
And maybe Buddhist teachers, you know, when Buddha was teaching, I don't know if Buddha asked somebody for the precepts, but probably his first disciples said, you know, could I please ordain with you to receive the family style? So
yes.
It's not this huge, humongous mystery, even though it's shrouded in mystery and it's a complete mystery, but this is kind of a practical, everyday thing. You know, could I please join up a little? Or I'm already joined, but I don't have a document around it, mm-hmm. Something like that.
So can I add a footnote? Can I add a footnote to your footnote?
Please.
To my footnote?
Yeah.
To Eric's footnote? Yeah, just that. So there is that practice that we do here, and a number of people here have received that, or in the process of preparing to receive the precepts and the lineage papers, which aren't really that secret. You know, you should, if you've received them, please, you know, take them out of the folded envelope and look at them.
Can't put them back together.
No, I'll put them back together.
I'll
fold them back together. I'll put them back together for you. That's all right. But I want to emphasize, and I was talking about this. Some of you were here yesterday. I was talking about The problem we have when this becomes glamorized, and the problem in American Zen of, you know, thinking that because somebody's wearing some robe that they're, you know, whatever. So we don't have perfect masters. We don't have, you know, sacred beings. We are all together in this family. And you don't have to do this ceremony to be totally part of the Buddhist family. You just show up and breathe and let your heart beat together. So I want to add that as a footnote. Now, some of us feel, some of us need extra kind of support, so we go through this, these ceremonies, and that's okay. But anyway, just so I want to emphasize that just the fact that you're here tonight means you're part of the Buddhist family, period. And just that you show up and are willing to be present and breathe and allow your heartbeat to continue on your cushion and sit upright and be willing to not run away from yourself, to be this body and mind. Buddha, as Eric was saying, Buddha is then present. So, and yes, we have these various ceremonies and these various other things you can do, and it's fine. And if you're interested in that, you know, come and see me about it. But just to be here, just to take this position of Buddha Mudra, we are this family. We are sharing the feast of Buddha together. So, Eric, thank you for setting the table for us.
Sorry to... didn't know I was letting any...
No. It's all right. It's okay. You can ask Eric to see the shiso. It's all right. It's not a big deal. Does anybody else, though, have any other time for one last comment or question, if anyone... Yes, Adam.
I took one of these rakusus and with Hogetsu, and I just wanted to thank her for allowing me to do that. And if you do decide to sew one, she's your sewing teacher, then you'll go into her house, and she's got this whole setup, and you'll have many months of wonderful tea and making tiny little stitches and. Pretty incredible process.
Yes, it is, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to bow to Hogetsu for all the things she does for us as our sewing teacher and our cook. All of us are doing this. So, yes, thank you, Adam, for your testimony, and all of us are in this process. Again, there are very specific practices we can take on to support and ornament this process, but by virtue of just zazen, just sitting, there's this process of finding our way to be Buddha, to allow Buddha to be present together, and we do this together. So, yeah, Clay.
I might be opening a can of worms here, and I'll do my best not to. It's quite apparent to me the benefit and value of having a sangha, having connectedness amongst one another present time now. But when we talk about heartbeat and transmission from our parents and their parents, and then when we talk about Zen lineage and teachings, it's not obvious to me the importance of any of that other than being, I mean, it's, you know, we work and we sit to be in the moment. And to be present. So it's not obvious to me the importance of the past.
Good question. So that's a whole other Dharma talk. But actually, it's the Dharma talk that Eric just gave, that we are here exactly because of the past and the future. We're connected to ancestors in the future as well. It's very important. This isn't, you know, we're here tonight. Is it a Monday night? Anyway, we're here, and this situation with these people is it. And many beings, past and future, are also present with you now, unavoidably, in your heartbeat, in your breath, in all the things that you care about. And you don't have to kind of think about them. You don't have to do some fancy ceremony about them. But I think it, you know, as Eric was saying, I think it adds some richness to our life to actually appreciate that we're not alone. Or we're alone, but we're alone as the expression of many beings. So this is something we can talk about more, but thank you for bringing up that question.